and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump's surprise announcement yesterday that he would pull all U.S. troops out of Syria has ignited a firestorm of opposition among the political elite. Democrats, even those who were historically anti-war, have joined Republicans in their outrage that the United States might, quote, lose, unquote, Syria. Next, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced this morning that he would unilaterally tighten work requirements related to food stamps, a move that threatens hundreds of thousands of people's access to the most basic of necessities. Then, despite ongoing negotiations, North Korea continues to suffer under a near-total economic blockade imposed by the United States and other world powers. This has had a devastating effect on the North Korean people, and now even their efforts to mitigate the damage through scientific research is being demonized as a nefarious military plot. And then it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And finally, a federal jury yesterday found a former Blackwater security contractor guilty of murder in the 2007 shootings of dozens of unarmed Iraqi civilians. This was the second time that former sniper Nicholas Slatton had been found guilty in the case. The first verdict was overturned. This comes as Donald Trump is intervening in the case of Green Beret Major Matthew Goldstein, who admitted to carrying out a summary execution of an Afghan prisoner. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
President Trump's surprise announcement yesterday that he would pull all U.S. troops out of Syria has ignited a firestorm of opposition among the political elite here in the United States. Democrats, even those who were historically, quote, anti-war, I'm putting air quotes around that, have joined Republicans in their outrage that the United States might, quote, lose, close quote, Syria. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, welcome back.
Pleasure to be with you.
I have to say I was a bit startled myself about this announcement. We had been hearing that the U.S. had not only established some temporary military bases inside Syria in the northern part of the country, including big parts of the country in the north that are east of the Euphrates River, but that some of the bases were appearing to be permanent military bases. The Pentagon has signaled over and over again that they were going to stay in Syria for a long time. What did you think of Trump's announcement?
Extremely surprising. As you're highlighting, everything that we heard before, and indeed every action which was taken in Syria, including the buildup of the military bases, they all indicated that this is not for short term, this is for long term. And indeed, that seemed to be the policy. And this was really very surprising and very shocking. And I think, in one side, I think it's really welcoming because when you look at the whole history of United States in the region and in particularly in Syria, it has really been very negative one. And even with the sort of within concept of fighting Daesh or ISIS, U.S. has been the least effective tool, according to many observers, it actually has encouraged and it really indeed sort of created the environment with ISIS and Daesh could be created and to flourish. So in some ways it's very welcoming, but in another way it's very shocking. And one cannot help to think that is this really yet again another statement as U.S. is leaving Syria in the same way that U.S. has left Afghanistan so many times or left Iraq so many times, and is this really part and policy that we hear one thing but actions or something else?
Masoud, let me read to you from the New York Times today, Thursday, December 20th, about this startling announcement by Donald Trump to remove U.S. troops from Syria. Here's the first sentence: President Trump has ordered the withdrawal of 2,000 American troops from Syria, bringing a sudden end to a military campaign that largely vanquished the Islamic State, but ceding a strategically vital country to Russia and Iran. Now, I have to tell you, I don't think you can get more imperialistic in terms of the language here, that the decision by America to leave a country which it's illegally occupying because it's not invited by the sovereign government of Assad, by leaving, they are ceding a strategically vital country to Russia and Iran. They might be ceding Syria to Syria. That might be a non-imperialist way of thinking about it. Anyway, let's get your reaction.
Yeah, well, there are many holes in this statement. I mean, really to think about, is it real that 2,000 soldiers defeated ISIS? And the fact that, if it wasn't because of Russia and Iran coordinated effort, ISIS would have continued their existence and expansion. And, these are realities. And then, as you very clearly saying, U.S. hasn't got any right to be there. And the Syrians have not expected or want them there. And the reality is that U.S. troops, the whole history in the region, they brought nothing except disarray, destruction and chaos, which actually created the environment for groups like Daesh to flourish. But I think there is another aspect that we need to address is, this sort of in the current situation, United States is not even wanted by its allies, Turkey, there, because United States have been very divisive in their policy vis-a-vis the Kurds. And, it hasn't even taken into account the interests of their allies, i.e. Turkey. They definitely are not taking the interests of Syria into heart. They have been involved in proactively trying to divide Syria into factions. And indeed, I think they're leaving. It will be quite a good sign of beginning to bring some sort of harmony to Syria, if indeed they are going to leave. And I think probably the only group who is going to really suffer and feel their empty space, and it will be the Kurds, because the Kurds were promised that U.S. is going to stay there and ensure their position and their interests in the region.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm just looking at a headline also in the New York Times right now. Kurdish fighters discuss releasing 3,200 ISIS prisoners. America's Kurdish allies in Syria are discussing the release of 3,200 ISIS prisoners, a prominent monitoring group and a Western official of the Anti-Islamic State Coalition said Thursday, a day after President Trump ordered the withdrawal of all American troops from the country. The suggestion by the headline is that the Kurds are angry. The Syrian Democratic Forces, that are largely Kurdish-led, are angry about Trump's startling announcement that the U.S. is leaving. But Mostafa Bali, the spokesman for the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, denied that there was any discussion of releasing prisoners from the Islamic State, also known as ISIS. Quote, any news coming from such sources is not reliable and not coming from us. I think that's important because we all have a tendency to bounce off the headlines or the latest news, and frequently the latest news isn't right, or it changes. And I want to also, with that in mind, there's a lot of media outlets in the United States right now that are up in arms because Vladimir Putin said that Trump is doing the right thing by leaving. And the headline right now of the New York Times is Putin welcomes Trump's Syria withdrawal, quote, Donald's right. Obviously making fun of what they consider to be a too close relationship between Trump and Putin. And Putin did say Donald's right, and I agree with him. But he also said, this is important, everybody, Putin also said, quote, we don't see any signs yet of the withdrawal of U.S. troops. How long has the United States been in Afghanistan? 17 years. And almost every year, they say, They're pulling out their troops, close quote. So again, this was Trump's announcement, but if he doesn't have the backing of the Pentagon, we'll see who's really in charge here.
I think also, you know, the reality is that, you know, if you go beyond this, Turkey is extremely pleased if indeed this pullout is a reality. And Syrians are going to be extremely pleased because they could sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel that they could get their country back. Because the fact of the matter is that the United States have been extremely divisive in Syria. It actually been created and supported and fueled the civil war. And indeed, their occupation of there, even with 2,000 soldiers, is really something that unwarranted. And I think the reality is that many people will be happy to see end of the United States being there. And I think within the region, definitely, and Syrians and others, they don't see United States as their savior against ISIS. They really they see United States as a occupying power which actually created all the problems rather than resolved it.
Masood Shajara is our guest. Masood is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Syria, whatever political problems existed in Syria, until 2011, Syria was at peace. I mean, more or less. It certainly didn't have a civil war. Any decision by the United States to leave or for this fighting to stop, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, it would seem to me that Syrians would just be, as all people are, when the possibility of peace breaking out, would have to be just so hopeful that this, in fact, is the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I really, if we take it just from a perspective of Syrians, which indeed it's the most important perspective to look at it, United States leaving and Daesh being defeated and being defeated quite some time, there is some cleaning up needs to be done still, but Daesh is not the sort of the danger that it was a few years ago. And it's a sort of it's a beginning of the end. And they want to have the independence of their country. They want to put their lives back together. They want to see end of this sort of colonial legacy of destroying the security and safety of just about every single Syrian, and disrupting their lives and making them into refugees all around the world, suffering in the way that is unprecedented. So I think is going to be a positive things forward. And as I said, Syrians don't see United States as a savior. And they see it as a problem rather than the solution.
That was the voice of Masood Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. We were talking to Masood from London. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced this morning that he would unilaterally tighten work requirements related to food stamps, a move that threatens hundreds of thousands of people's access to the most basic of necessities. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. Anoa is the Director of Political Advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army. She is also the host of the show The Way with Anoa. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. Anoa, Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Gosh, what a nice holiday greeting, a holiday gift from the U.S. government to low-income people or people who have food insecurity in their family. Quite amazing, isn't it? Anoa, go ahead.
Yeah, but this is what Republicans like to do, right? I mean, they like to prove for their donors or whomever, whether it's, you know, Skeletor, I don't really know what it is that they're trying to prove to or who they're trying to prove to, but they like to try and prove that they're tough and they want to make people work. And what the problem is that Democrats have often negotiated, as we saw with the 1996 welfare reform authorization, TANF, temporary assistance to needy families that redefined welfare as we knew it under then President Clinton. You know, we see Democrats often too busy trying to appease these Republican delusions about able-bodied people who need incentives to work. I mean, it's not that people need incentives to work, and especially right now during the holidays, and it's already a time when people are already probably cash-strapped more than usual because of all that capitalism society puts on us to fixate on in the holidays. There's actually a movie about a single mom that has to do odd jobs like driving Uber and being like an assistant on one of those app things because she loses her job at the holidays. Like this is a reality right now in America, and it's making its way into our entertainment too, right? So when we're talking about, you know, what is even at stake, we're talking about, according to the we're talking about, on average, a recipient household receiving $253 a month. And the average adult person that is like receiving it, that doesn't have dependents, is not receiving $250 a month. So you're expecting people to lose whatever little bit of assistance that might be helping them get through, but then also trying to demand that they work for this little bit of assistance that, quite frankly, if you make just, you know, a little bit too much money, you would lose anyway. So it's a lot of BS, and it would be great if Democrats and others would push back on the BS and really fight for, you know, working class people and poor. But I mean, this is what Republicans do. This is what they've continued to do. And unfortunately, the other side just caves into them.
Walter Smolarek, in 2017, that would be last year, an estimated 1 in 8 Americans were food insecure, equating to 40 million Americans, including more than 12 million kids, children. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, defines food insecurity as a lack of consistent access to enough food for an active and healthy life. 40 million Americans have food insecurity last year, 1 in 8. And here you have the U.S. government figuring out how to make sure that low-income, hungry people have a harder time getting access to food.
It's completely disgusting. And, you know, the concept of rights in the United States, you know, when we talk about, you know, what are the rights guaranteed to all people, people would probably say, because, you know, this is what's in the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, oh, people have the right to free speech and assembly and freedom of religion. But shouldn't we also have the right to something so fundamental as food? I mean, the thing that, you know, people, you starve, right? If you don't have food, everybody needs food. And this is a country that, you know, spends hundreds of billions of dollars every year on war, really more like $1 trillion, that, you know, just gave away, well, there are some estimates, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars to rich people and corporations in the form of tax cuts. You know, it's just the wealthiest country in the history of humanity, really. And yet there's still millions and millions of people, tens of millions of people, including many, many children, who go hungry. So shouldn't food for everybody, regardless of whether or not you meet some arbitrary requirement that's, you know, constantly changing and unevenly applied, shouldn't everybody have food?
Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point. And Noah, Walter's right. The Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution, much vaunted, is really a set of, it's kind of a negative rights. It's the right, it stops the government from taking away your right to speak or your right to practice your religion. It stops the government from taking away your gun. It stops the government from searching and seizing your stuff. Of course, the government doesn't actually abide by these rights, but on the paper, at least, it says that's the goal. But there's not affirmative rights, like the right to eat and the right to employment and the right, you know, all the other rights that people actually fundamentally need to have a good life. The number of people who are food insecure, they don't have the right to food, 40 million, that's the size of the population of Canada. That's pretty staggering when you think about it like that.
I really appreciate that context, too. And the other thing, like, look, like they have been steadily whittling down. And granted, the Republicans have done this with Democrat help. Like they've been whittling down the population that has received and benefited from food stamps, what's now called SNAP. And this misnomer that this is some lifelong thing that people are just on. While there are some instances where that could possibly be true, the average family is receiving less than, what, 2 or 3 years of benefits. You know, the average person who is, most people are working, you have a household where someone is working. Some of these, even though we're talking about able-bodied adults, with no dependents, some of these rules that they're trying to change could also impact able-bodied adults with children over the age of 6. The greatest recipients of food stamp benefits are children in households that are struggling or in some percentage near the poverty level, either below or slightly above. And so we have, you know, Sunny Purdue's quote is saying, like, well, we have all these jobs out here and people need to go get them. You have temporary work that is available, right? You also have a misnomer in the way in which you're looking at when and how people work. There are periods of times when people need support between gaps in employment. Unfortunately, when you have like side jobs, temporary jobs, there is a whole economy that they're talking about. These are jobs available. People can just work. But it's not like these are full-time jobs that are paying a wage that people can actually afford to live. How many times have we all discussed that Walmart workers, people in fast food, et cetera, are receiving, you know, some form of government assistance to be able to supplement? It seems like there should be legislation, regulation passed to address the fact that employers should be paying their employees what they need to live, should be hiring people in a way that they can actually afford to live instead of having to rely on the gap and using that as a way to force people into work. Like, it's also like, I remember back in early 2000s when I was an undergrad as a young mother with a toddler and the whole fight over work requirements and whether or not things like work study, which was a real job that I had on campus, which I really did work up to 20 hours a week and stuff, whether or not that would even count as work. Like, it also depended upon who, the fact that we were even in school was an issue. So there's been a long battle. Like I said, this goes back to 96 under Clinton. When I was in college, we were struggling and fighting, and a group of single mothers went to D.C. to protest under Bush. Like, this is an ongoing thing, and people literally don't understand what is going on in households across America. People aren't just sitting there twiddling their thumbs, cashing a check that does not come to most people and waiting for food stamp benefits, which is minimal when you think about what it actually costs to eat and live and feed a family, actually healthy, good food.
That's Anoa Changa. Walter, really, really important points that Anoa is making. I want to give some more statistics. The statistics say a lot. How much do you get in food stamps? For example, a household of three with a net income of $1,500 must subtract $450, that's 30% of $1,500, from the maximum allotment for their household, which is $511 per month. They then subtract the $450 from the $511 maximum. The household will receive a food stamp allotment of $61 for the month. That's what we're talking about. $61 average if you have a $1,500 monthly income for a family of three.
Yeah, it's completely outrageous. And what they're doing, and, you know, Anoa made the point about, you know, some of these states that have big agricultural sectors actually benefiting from the food stamps program. And yet the right wing politicians in those states are still opposed to it. I mean, the fact that, you know, there's a big faction of the U.S. political establishment that thinks like, oh, this is a winning issue. Like, this is the thing that we want to campaign on, you know, taking away food from hungry people. You know, and, you know, there's this ideology of like, oh, well, you know, if anybody who wants to be not poor can be not poor if they just work hard and get a job or whatever, which is like obviously not how the economy works. And so, you know, it's just, I think it's a reflection of sort of the brutality of the system itself. And the fact that it's such a small amount of money that they want to take away from people. I mean, clearly it's not based on, you know, the desire to be fiscally responsible. I mean, they do plenty of things that aren't quote unquote fiscally responsible. You know, like send people off to war, like, you know, giving tax breaks to rich people and their corporations. But yeah, I mean, for working people, there's never any resources.
I know, with 30 seconds left, I mentioned 40 million people are food insecure in 2017 in the United States. That's the size of the population of Canada. If there is another economic recession, and of course there will be, it's just a matter of when under the capitalist system, but it might be soon, that number is going to soar. And at this moment, you have Sunny Purdue making sure that fewer people have access to food stamps. Really something. 30 seconds, you get the last word.
I just think that this is another thing that we all need to be vigilant about. This will go, this will be posted in the Federal Register. There will be a comment period. People need to organize, mobilize, and make sure that we are being very vocal about this, because this is not something that, this is the other side of Fight for 15 and all the other movements and efforts that we're out here pushing for. I mean, making sure that families have, and individuals, we shouldn't ignore younger individuals, millennials, whomever, older folks who are underemployed, unemployed, or just not able to sustain life we need to make sure they have what they need to survive. I mean, freedom to thrive should be, it should be a protected right here. And that's just what it is.
And you are right. And Noah, people have an opportunity to post public comments, to send public comments. They become part of the record. They become, in fact, if there's litigation, very, very important. That's all the time we have. We were joined from Atlanta, Georgia, by Anoa Changa. She is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army. Anoa is also the host of the show called The Way with Anoa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm in studio with co-host John Kiriakou. Despite ongoing negotiations, North Korea continues to suffer under near-total economic blockade imposed by the United States and other world powers at the United Nations who have gone along with the United States. This has had a devastating effect on the people of the DPRK, North Korea, and now even their efforts to mitigate the damage through scientific research of their own is being demonized as a nefarious military plot by none other than National Public Radio. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim Beal, welcome back.
Hi, Brian. Good to be back.
Tim Beal, I have to say, I was up way too early, 5:30 in the morning. I turned on NPR. I heard this story condemning North Korea for engaging in scientific and scholarly activity because it would help North Korea develop indigenous technologies that could mitigate the stifling impact of economic sanctions on their country. And I thought, like, what an imperialist news broadcast this National Public Radio story was. And of course, it is just that. You got a chance to look at it. What was your impression?
Well, yes, it is. Gosh, you would take it on many, many levels. I mean, first of all technology, virtually all technology you can possibly think of is dual use. So that's their argument that, if you work on, they mention various things, axles and driving systems and bacteria for curing diseases, that in fact can have a military application. That's the tool, if you like, because that is true. But that's not really what it's about. I mean, there's two things here. I think a lot of the sanctions, I mean, they want to destroy, of course. They want to destroy North Korea. They want to impede its economic development. They want to, to make it collapse, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one aspect. I think the other aspect is that as long as there's this stress on sanctions, then the United States is not going to negotiate seriously with North Korea. So if you want to stop these negotiations, because a lot of these people, their jobs depends on lack of peace, then pushing for sanctions is the way to do it. Because as long as the administration thinks that sanctions is going to get it what it wants, then it's not going to negotiate. As long as it imposes sanctions, the Koreans are not going to believe any promises that the Americans, have benign attitude towards them. So it, puts a stopper on things.
Yes, we're talking to Tim Beal about the National Public Radio story that condemns North Korea for engaging in scholarly and academic work and scientific work and working with Chinese scientists in particular to develop independent indigenous technologies to mitigate the terrible impact on the people of North Korea as a consequence of economic sanctions and isolation. And again, let's remind everyone, North Korea is being sanctioned because they've sent ballistic missile tests or that they tested nuclear weapons, something the other members of the Security Council, and most notably the United States, do every day. But if North Korea does it, the imposition of vast draconian economic sanctions. I want to read a little bit from this story. One of the authors, Joshua Pollack, a scholar at Middlebury Institute, who co-authored the analysis along with independent researcher Scott LaFoy, he says, quote, about the way they do this scholarly work, this is in part how North Koreans go about beating sanctions. The revelation comes at a critical time for the United States. Kim Jong-un pledged to work towards complete denuclearization of the North Korean peninsula. Science is revered by the North Korean state. This is NPR. Scientists in the communist nation are given new high-rise apartments and are praised in speeches by Kim. The North Korean regime regards their scientists as a valuable asset for many reasons. Then they quote Ki Park, a neurosurgeon at Harvard Medical School. Park has seen firsthand just how valuable science can be to the isolated nation. North Korean medical researchers often have outdated equipment and scant resources, but they have developed and manufactured their own ultrasound machines, built a medical CT scanner from scratch, and more. Quote, and this is from the Harvard-based neurosurgeon, quote, they are now manufacturing their own artificial knee implants. They're implanting them on their own patients, which to me is remarkable. Park says he thinks research like this is designed to improve the lives of North Korea's impoverished citizenry. Other research qualifies as truly fundamental science, such as an ongoing study of the volcanic Mount Paektu by North Korea and Western geologists. And then we have in this story, Tim Beal, representatives from American think tanks like Elizabeth Rosenberg, a senior fellow with the Center for a New American Security, and a former Treasury official in the Obama administration, who says, quote, it certainly does appear that some of this joint scholarly activity should not have been done, because some of the same technologies to fix knees or to drive cars or provide people with clean drinking water could be conceivably used, Tim Beal, for military technologies. I mean, that's criminal.
Yes, well, she is a sanctions woman. She comes from Treasury. She's worked on sanctions against various countries. And, you know, what they do, sanctions is a weapon. And, you know, one of the points about sanctions that you is designed to increase the distress, the economic distress, the well-being, et cetera, of the people. So they turn against their government and the government collapses and, you know, you take over. I mean, that's what sanctions are about. From her point of view, I guess quite reasonably sees sanctions as an important weapon. But it is a weapon, yes, yeah. And of course, it's mainly the vulnerable, the old, the children, and sick, etc., who suffer. But you know that doesn't concern people like Rosenberg.
Again, going back to Park, the neurosurgeon from Harvard, who NPR quotes here. Just listen to this. I'll give you an example. The Harvard neurosurgeon says, explaining why dual use research doesn't have to be limited to missiles and bombs. He says, I'll give you an example. When you study infectious diseases, which are a big burden in North Korea, you have to grow bacteria. That's the kind of technology that goes into creating biological weapons. So they can't even produce medicine. They can't even produce medicine because eventually growing antibiotics as medicine, growing this bacteria, could be conceivably used in a biological weapon. On that basis, on the basis of that thinking, North Korea does not have the right to engage in science at all, or any kind of engineering, any kind of high technology, any kind of, well, let's face it, modern society.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yes, it goes right across the board, because as I was saying, virtually everything can be described as dual use if you use enough imagination about it. So, I mean, Key Park is in a sense a goodie. I mean, he's a neurosurgeon, runs trips to North Korea, et cetera, so, and he's obviously very impressed by the dedication of the Korean scientists, how they've managed to cope with sanctions. And he mentions equipment, but they also have to develop these medicines, because a lot of them, in fact, they can't get for various reasons because of sanctions. So he's very impressed by how they are trying to cope and help the people. But that, of course, is not the point of sanctions. Sanctions is attempting to do the opposite. Sanctions is attempting to hurt the people. So, as I said, they will dislike the government and cause it to collapse.
Tim Beal, I agree with you. I think the Harvard neurosurgeon, I want to make this clear, I don't think he's being hostile I think the way the story is quoting him, though, is kind of using him to make their point, which is that they shouldn't develop any technology. Because, again, he says, I'll give you an example. When you study infectious diseases, which are a big burden in North Korea, you have to grow bacteria. That's the kind of technology that goes into creating biological weapons. That's how they quote him, as if he's for that. But at the very end of the story, he says, would you then say to the North Koreans and to the Chinese that you cannot do research on the things that killed their people? Okay, that's how the story ends. But the whole implication of this story is that North Korea actually shouldn't be allowed to be involved in modern civilized existence, that they have to go back 300 or 400 years so that we are all guaranteed that they will not in the future have a nuclear weapon or a biological weapon or a chemical weapon. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We were joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. It's time again for our weekly segment with Veterans for Peace, and it's called Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect military veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, and he's currently national president of Veterans for Peace. Jerry Condon, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here, Brian.
Quite a few stories to cover. Again, let's start right away because time is short. The VFP, Veterans for Peace, after Donald Trump activated and sent U.S. military forces to the U.S.-Mexican border, you too went to the Mexican border, but with a different message. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, we've been actually reaching out to the soldiers, telling them they'll have our support if they refuse to obey illegal orders to repress the asylum seekers. We're also very involved with urgent humanitarian aid efforts. We have a chapter of Veterans for Peace, our deported veterans chapter in Tijuana, that's doing some terrific work. Actually, it's a situation at the border created by Trump's refusal to obey U.S. and international law on refugees. It's quite dire. Many organizations on both sides of the border have stepped up to provide humanitarian aid, but there's a lot of needs there still. And this week, we had a kind of a tragic situation. Two teenage asylum seekers were strangled to death when they left their encampment. And apparently, there's been a few young Mexican citizens were arrested, and it's not yet clear what the motive was. But there have been some tensions fanned up by right-wing racist groups in Mexico, as well as from the U.S. side, and, of course, Mr. Trump himself. So we've been providing San Diego Veterans for Peace, along with the Deported Veterans Chapter in Tijuana, has been providing clothing, food, water, toilet paper, sanitary napkins, and other essential supplies. There's now a link on the Veterans for Peace national website where people can donate directly to this effort. We're also inviting photojournalists and videographers and writers to come down, and join our effort, and to document the situation in Tijuana so we can help build pressure for really changing the situation there. We were relieved to see that a federal judge struck down Trump's executive orders against hearing asylum claims from those who are fleeing domestic violence and gang violence. So that's good. Another federal judge earlier had issued an injunction against Trump's executive order not to hear asylum claims from those who arrive in the U.S., quote-unquote, illegally or outside an official port of entry. There's a lot of media attention right now on the plight of thousands of unaccompanied minors who are suffering in mass internment camps on the U.S. side of the border, particularly the Tornillo tent camp near El Paso, where thousands of migrant youth are being held in very bad conditions. So it's important we keep the pressure up on the government to follow the law and grant asylum to these desperate refugee families. And we're also engaging in protest actions here in San Diego. On Friday, January 11th, there's going to be a protest downtown. And then at the border crossing in San Ysidro border crossing on Saturday, January 12th. So it's really important that we combine political action with material aid and solidarity for these asylum seekers.
That's the voice of Jerry Condon. Jerry joins us every Thursday in this segment called Veterans for Peace. Jerry is the national president of the organization Veterans for Peace. It's really something, Jerry. You have a chapter of Veterans for Peace. These are American, U.S. military veterans, but you have a deported veterans chapter in Mexico. How could it be that U.S. military veterans have been deported by the U.S. government, the same government that they were serving? What is that?
Well, it's just another reflection of a really screwed up, unjust immigration policy overall. But in this case, it's also a question of letting down veterans. Another example of how veterans are let down. These were people who arrived in the U.S. as young children with their families, and they grew up in the U.S. It's the only country they really know. They, for one reason or another, they had not yet become citizens. But many of them actually entered the military hoping that they would. That would help them become citizens. But the military never followed through, didn't help them get their citizenship. Instead, sent them off to multiple deployments to war and all the way back going to Vietnam, but also more recently Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And when they got out, like a lot of other veterans, they, especially after multiple tours, suffering from PTSD and other serious injuries and self-medicated, got themselves in trouble with the law. Next thing you know, they're in jail. And when they got out of jail, instead of sending them back to their families and their communities, they were just taken to the border, you know, maybe with $20 in their pocket, if that, and a jacket, and just pushed across the border. Okay, bye-bye. So this is really an outrage, and everybody who hears about it, no matter what their politics are across the political spectrum, just can't hardly believe it. But these guys have organized themselves into a strong community on the Mexico side of the border. They're succeeding in getting quite a bit of attention and political support in the United States. But in the meantime, they've admirably taken a lead not for the first time either, in helping out these caravans of Central American asylum seekers with whom they feel a lot in common.
Talk about the government mistreating veterans. I know we have other stories, but I can't but mention the fact that the Government Accountability Office, GAO, report released on Monday says suicide prevention efforts by the Department of Veterans Affairs fell off sharply in the last 2 years, even though reducing the high suicide rate among veterans is the agency's top clinical priority. And the department's top management in turmoil, the suicide prevention effort lacked leadership. Planning meetings were repeatedly canceled. It's shocking. It's shocking.
And on top of that, suicide rate among veterans is actually rising. There was just a news story yesterday. So it's going up. So it's just, you know, there's a long history, you know, going back as far as you can go back, probably, but certainly Vietnam with Agent Orange, the first Gulf War with the Gulf War syndrome, and now with PTSD, suicide. Like, we're talking about 22 suicides per day. That's combined veterans and active duty, I believe. And so there's this huge epidemic of people who are suffering the consequences of these wars, who were sent there by people who never fought in a war themselves, and yet they're happy to use the veterans to say, we got to support the troops, we got to support our veterans, but they're not really supporting the troops or the veterans. They're only using them to drum up support for and to be the cannon fodder in wars that are only in the interest of the super rich.
Well, let's talk about Syria real quick, Jerry Condon. Donald Trump's startling announcement that he was going to remove the 2,000 U.S. troops. There may be more in Syria. Weirdly, Republicans and Democrats, even liberals, even people you and I have perhaps worked with or had some association with historically in the anti-war movement, because Trump is pulling them out, people are saying, oh, this is terrible. It's certainly for the people of Syria. I mean, those troops are there illegally. They haven't been invited by the Syrian government. They're not there because of a UN mandate. I'm quite sure if those troops are pulled out, even though the media says the soldiers are crying now because if they come out, their job won't have been fully completed. I'm just guessing those men and women would be glad to get out of Syria and come home and be at home with their families. Anyway, what's your take on Syria?
Well, I think it's good news that the U.S. is going to be pulling all the troops out of Syria. It remains to be seen, you know, what will actually happen, because here we have a situation where the president, the so-called commander-in-chief, we're not sure. It's not clear whether he's really in charge of U.S. foreign policy or calls the shots as to where the U.S. is intervening, because he's getting all this pushback now from the State Department, from the Pentagon, even from the, you know, foreign minister of Great Britain. There's a lot of people somehow have an investment in keeping the U.S. in Syria. For what reason? To stoke up a possible war with Iran. It's just crazy. So I'm sure those active duty, I doubt if there's a single troop in Syria that's crying because they're going to be coming home to their families. So I hope it's true that they'll really bring the troops out of Syria. It's time to kind of reverse, get out of all these failed, tragic, unwinnable wars. And it's interesting to see that the U.S. government is also now in talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan, perhaps with an eye to getting the troops out of Afghanistan, as President Trump has also stated several times he would like to do. You know, I rarely agree with Trump on anything, but if he wants to pull the troops out of where they don't belong, I'm all for it. And so is Veterans for Peace.
Yeah, I think that's important. We're not fans of Donald Trump by any stretch of the imagination. Far from it. We've organized many activities against Donald Trump. But you're right, Jerry. You know what? I think a lot of people, especially in battleground states in the Midwest, where a lot of their young people have been sent off to war after war, I think some people in 2016 were worried, actually, that if Hillary Clinton became president, given her embrace of the Iraq invasion, the bombing of Libya, like every possible war, that Hillary Clinton would be another war. And it's going to be working class kids, not, you know, the kids of the affluent who go and fight and die. 30 seconds left.
That's right. I mean, I think some people voted for Trump actually because they wanted to get out of these wars. And he said he was going to get us out of them. So it's important. That's one campaign pledge I'll be happy to see him keep. And I'm also just in the last few seconds say also glad to see the Senate has voted against funding the U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. And the situation there seems to be turning around just in time to keep millions of Yemeni children from starving to death, as tens of thousands apparently already have. So it's time to get out of these stupid imperial wars and to have a new future for this world.
Yeah, well put. That was the voice of Jerry Condon. We were talking to Jerry from California. He is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister. He's been a peace and solidarity activist for 50 years. He's currently the national president of Veterans for Peace. He joins us every Thursday here on Loud and Clear in this segment called Veterans for Peace. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short message, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. A federal jury yesterday found a former Blackwater security contractor guilty of murder in the 2007 shootings of dozens of unarmed Iraqi civilians. This was the second time that former sniper Nicholas Slatin had been found guilty in the case. The first verdict was overturned. This comes as Donald Trump is intervening in the case of Green Beret Major Matthew Goldstein, who admitted to carrying out a summary execution of an Afghan prisoner. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Kevin, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Good to talk to both of you.
Thank you. This was a big decision, especially given the fact that the earlier convictions had been overturned of at least four of the Blackwater mercenary contractors who shot and killed so many people that day in Baghdad. I'm sure they killed other people on other days. But Nicholas Slatin has been found guilty. It carries a first-degree murder. It carries a mandatory life in prison. Go ahead.
Well, it's an amazingly important case, and it's impressive that the prosecutors stayed with it after it being overturned and continued to prosecute. Now, this case got major attention. The United Nations was involved. Congress was involved. The Iraqi government was involved. So it got a lot of spotlight on it. I think that's one reason why you saw this prosecution continue through to the conviction yesterday. And it's one of a number of incidents involving Blackwater. Blackwater is a security company, a private military company. It's gone through multiple names. It's now known as Academy. It was known as XE for a while. And it wants to really take over the Afghanistan war. It wants to, it's been trying to convince Eric Prince, the founder, has been trying to convince Donald Trump to privatize the Afghanistan war, which would be, I think, a disaster. And hopefully this case will help to prevent that from happening.
Right. And Eric Prince is also the brother of Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, who wants to privatize public schools. So it's the privatization family, very tied into right-wing, very wealthy donors. Let's talk about what actually happened that day in 2007, Kevin Zeese.
Well, of course, there's lots of controversy about what actually happened that day. But it was in Baghdad. They were escorting a car, and they saw a car coming at them, they thought, which the Blackwater folks assumed was carrying explosives. They opened fire on the car before anything happened. Then Iraqi police got involved shooting, but Blackwater people assumed they were not really police, and they started shooting. And dozens of people were injured, 17 were killed, and it got national attention, international attention. Blackwater's license was revoked to operate in Iraq for a while because of the pressure that went on it. And then reports came out about other Blackwater killings, a horrible incident in Fallujah where a Blackwater car was shot at, killed four people. They were hung from a bridge, kind of a symbolic response to their abuse. And Blackwater really was one of these corporations that were involved profiting from Iraq that made the Iraq occupation a failure and a disgrace for the United States. And sadly, they as I said, they want to expand this and privatize more wars. Exactly the wrong way to go.
That's the voice of Kevin Zeese. Kevin is talking to us from Baltimore. He is one of the leaders of the popularresistance.org website, one of the writers, editors. Be sure to go to their website, popularresistance.org, not simply to talk about Iraq, but there's so many international and domestic issues where finally you get a progressive analysis, a progressive assessment. You have the facts. Be sure to go to their website, popularresistance.org. Let's go back to that event in 2007. On Wednesday morning this week, a jury has found Slatton, the sniper with Blackwater, and almost all of the Blackwater mercenaries are retired U.S. military personnel, guilty of first-degree murder, a charge that, as I mentioned in the beginning, carries a mandatory life sentence. 14 unarmed Iraqi civilians were killed by those Blackwater guards that day on September 16, 2007. 10 women, 2 men, and 2 children were killed in the shooting. 18 others were shot. The prosecutors said that Mr. Slatton was the first to fire the gunshots, and it was unprovoked into a busy square. Now, later, the Blackwater guards, including Slatton, said, "Hey, we saw a car coming." Well, yeah, they were on a road, and we thought the car was coming towards us. But they just started doing full-spectrum shooting. They shot up that entire Nisr Square in Baghdad, and so many people were shot, and so many people died, including, and all of them civilians, including children. And I think, Kevin, that the real feeling amongst these mercenaries, they're not under military discipline. They're not part of the chain of command. They expect that they will not be held accountable. They felt that they had the run of the place. And of course, they're getting big contracts from the George W. Bush administration. You had Dick Cheney, who was the former CEO of Halliburton, also making lots of money on the Iraq war. They felt, and Eric Prince, their founder, felt, we can do whatever we want. We're not accountable. The Iraqis don't have the ability. The Iraqis did not have the ability to hold them accountable for crimes. There was a condition of what's called extraterritoriality, meaning colonial powers in particular always said when they were colonizing people that the colonized people did not have the right to bring the colonizers to justice, no matter what crime they committed. I think Blackwater and Slatton and all of them were feeling like, we don't care about Iraqis. They're not white. They're Arabs. They're using lots of racist language about them. We can shoot them and nothing's going to happen to us. I think that's what they really, really thought. And I think that's why this massacre happened.
And that's what's so interesting about this prosecution happening and being repeated after the convictions were thrown out. I think you're right, though. If you look there, there are many reports of Blackwater security guards opening fire onto unarmed Iraqis. This incident got a lot of attention because it was such a blatant and massive attack into an area where lots of people were walking and driving. But these kinds of attacks happened regularly. Blackwater, there's many incidents involving Blackwater. It's incredible that they would even be considered a legitimate corporation under U.S. law. And I think the reason they changed their name multiple times is to try to run away from their Blackwater history. But, this is part of a series of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries. John Bolton, this national security advisor, has threatened the International Criminal Court with sanctions if they investigate U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, for example, because there are a lot of war crimes. And there's a great fear of the U.S. government being held accountable for its actions. When Bolton was in the Bush administration, he prevented the Bush administration, George Bush, from recognizing the ICC. And he warned them that the ICC could be used to prosecute U.S. officials. And in fact, U.S. officials have been involved in various war crimes, U.S. military officials. And then, of course, you have to go up the chain of command, up now to President Trump, who's trying to intervene into a case in Afghanistan involving a former major who took out and killed someone who was suspected and not proven of anything in Afghanistan. So, and he's trying to intervene in that case. Totally inappropriate role for the president to play, especially a commander in chief dealing with the military situation. So the U.S. needs to recognize at some point it's going to be held accountable. The ICC is moving toward holding Israel accountable for war crimes. Bolton threatened the ICC on that as well. But I don't see that down the future. I would not be surprised to see the ICC start to hold U.S. officials accountable as well. That can happen.
That's the voice of Kevin Zeese. He's with Popular Resistance. Go to their website, popularresistance.org. There were so many massacres during the U.S. invasion of Iraq. There was the Haditha killings. U.S. Marines on November 19, 2005, murdered 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians. They raped and murdered young Iraqi girls. That was because they had taken casualties in an earlier firefight the day or two before with resistance fighters. So they just went in and they decided to get the revenge against Arabs, against Iraqis. 24 people were murdered. I wrote quite a bit about that at the time of the Haditha massacre. At the end of the day, only one of the people who was brought to trial, one of the Marines, was found guilty. He received a rank reduction and pay cut, but avoided jail time. And I have to say, Iraqis expressed complete disbelief and voiced outrage because that was a six-year-long military prosecution that ended with none of the Marines sentenced to incarceration, not one of them. And nobody disputes that this was a massacre of unarmed civilians, the rape and killing of Iraqis. And they got one of them got a rank reduction and a cut in pay. When we think about this kind of thing, and Americans always are told, fear Arabs, fear Muslims. When you really look at objectively at what's going on, there's a reason people in the Muslim world and in the Arab world have these kind of oceans of discontent and resentment against Western countries in particular that occupy them. Kevin Zeese, we have 20 seconds left. You take us out.
I'll just say that, millions of people have now seen the collateral murder video, which WikiLeaks published, came from the Chelsea Manning leaks, that showed U.S. military firing on civilians, including reporters. You could hear them talking about getting, how they wanted to really blow up this van, people trying to rescue those who had already been shot in the first round. So the ugliness of U.S. Military actions, U.S. war crimes, is becoming more widely known in the United States and around the world. At some point, U.S. officials will be held accountable, and it's time for U.S. to change its behavior and to recognize that reality.
That was Kevin Zeese. We talked to Kevin from Baltimore. He is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.